from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In November of 2002, Jennifer Granholm was elected to what Barack Obama would someday call the toughest job in America, governor of Michigan. Throughout most of Granholm's two terms in office, Michigan was in free fall. The state lost over 70% of its automotive jobs, and unemployment peaked at over 14%. Now Granholm and her husband Dan Mulhern have written a new book called A Governor's Story. It's a tale of not only what faced Michigan, but the challenge that continues to face America as a whole, the fight for jobs. And it's also the story of Granholm and Mulhern's journey as a couple through challenging times. Former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm and Dan Mulhern, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. To say the first decade of the 21st century was tough for Michigan doesn't do justice to those traumatic 10 years. Unemployment reached 14%. The big three automakers hemorrhaged jobs, with GM and Chrysler eventually forced into bankruptcy. Major layoffs by Michigan firms became an almost daily occurrence. Things got so tough that Comerica Bank, whose name graced the Detroit Tiger baseball stadium, moved their headquarters to Texas. And the Detroit Lions football team finished the 2008 season 0-16. But as former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm and her husband Dan Mulhern observe in their new book, the global economic hurricane may have hit Michigan first and hardest, but it's coming to a community near you. Granholm served as Michigan's governor for 8 years, from January 2003 to January 2011, and the book details that stormy time and the lessons the Michigan experience may offer the rest of America. Today, both former Governor Granholm and Dan Mulhern teach at the University of California, Berkeley. Granholm is a distinguished practitioner of law and public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy. Mulhern is a distinguished practitioner of law and business at the University of California, Berkeley Law School. Their new book, A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Happy to have you both here.
Yeah, happy to,
happy to be here.
There's so many statistics that can get piled up with tough economic times, and sometimes they don't really tell the full story. But Governor Granholm, I wonder if you would tell one story, which caught me reading the book, about something called the WARN notice. There was a time at one point where you got something like 55 of these in one 30-day period. Describe what they are and what they meant.
Yeah, the WARN Act is a requirement that when employers are about to engage in a mass layoff, which is 50 people or more, they have to send a notice warning both the employees as well as the state you happen to be located in, that a big action is about to occur. And, you know, normally, in normal times, those are kind of rare occurrences. And it tips everybody off that you may need to help provide some services to the employees that might be affected. Now, in Michigan, especially after the meltdown on Wall Street and the, you know, complete closing up of capital. It was like an engine locking up. So the suppliers to the auto industry and everywhere around the country felt it. But in Michigan, because we had the combination of nobody buying cars and therefore no parts necessary, nobody able to borrow any money to get through this period of time, the WARN Act notices were astonishing. They just kept on coming. I remember being at the White House one day because I was begging for the White House to step in to assist the auto industry. And my beeper, because I would get beeped whenever we got a WARN Act notice, my phone kept rolling in these notices. And I was showing them to Gene Sperling, who is now the head of the Economic Council for the President, and Steve Rattner, who was head of the auto, you know, he was called the auto czar, head of the bailout team. You know, look what's coming in every single moment. I'm getting WARN Act notices from companies. This is an emergency for us. So yeah, it was a really, you know, it was a stressful decade, but that period of time where it was the auto industry was uncertain whether they would survive, and therefore the ripple effect on the rest of the economy was astonishing. It was an amazing moment.
And I remember you talking to Janet Napolitano, governor of Arizona at the time, and saying, "Yeah, Governor, how many WARN Act notices have you had?" And she said, "Oh, I don't know, why, probably a couple, two or three." Why? And you told her you'd had something like 300 in a stretch of a year.
The book begins with this image of you, Dan Mulhern, on election night, bouncing on the bed in excitement. Contrast that moment of euphoria with what you're just describing.
Oh, I you could hardly have a more stark contrast, Dave. I mean, that was a moment of absolute jubilation, and campaigns are wonderful experiences because you win or you lose. It's the World Series. It's the Super Bowl. And so to win was incredible. To experience a moment that I talk about in the book when Jennifer gets off the phone having talked to President Obama, who says, we're putting GM in bankruptcy. I'm not sure I've ever felt such a low, and I felt it nothing compared to Jennifer, who I always said had 10 million people, the people of Michigan, on her back, and that was a flattening moment.
On my back, meaning pulling them, trying to pull the state along with me, not
burdened by. I mean, as a result, but yes, trying to pull them up the hill, get them out of this, you know, this dungeon, this cave that Michigan was so trapped in.
You write early on in the book, and then come back to this toward the end, about why Michigan means more than Michigan. Not that that in and of itself isn't, of course, tremendously important, but that it is a harbinger for what we're facing now. Why is that? What is it about what happened during your time as governor that's so telling about what America now faces?
Right. It's a cautionary tale because everybody right now is scratching their head going, how come this there's such persistent and long-term joblessness in America? How do you create jobs in the United States? Everybody's asking, what's the role of government in doing that? Why is the private sector not hiring? What's going on? Well, what's going on in the country is what happened in Michigan in the first decade. We thought that we were going to emerge from the 2001-2002 recession and that we were just in a cycle and that the cycle would take its natural uptick. And a lot of the language that's being used today about America's economy is, oh, we have to do these measures to get through this recession, or this will, you know, short-term stimulus that will allow us to bounce back, as though there will be some sort of natural uptick. Our point is that in Michigan, this was a structural change to our economy, and that is what's happening in America. And the structure that's changing is the sectors of the nation's economy are taking advantage of the globe. Globalization and the flattening of the world is flat, as Tom Friedman would say, and technology and the movement of capital and jobs, the flows that have happened. Michigan is sort of the poster child for it, but it's happening all over the country, and it's not just in manufacturing. Of course, it's in services and elsewhere too. So the question for us is, as a nation, how do you crack the code in a global economy to create jobs in America?
And there seems to be this fierce debate right now in this country, and that's what I'd like you to speak to, between on the one hand the idea that we need to cut taxes to make it as easy as we can for private individuals and small businesses to create jobs and government get out of the way, and the other of a much more activist view. Given your experience in Michigan, what do we need to do at this point to change this seemingly almost insoluble problem? Even the Economic News Today was, again, sort of flat.
Right.
What is it that's going to push us to a new place?
So if the states are the laboratories of democracy, here's what we learned. Here's the evidence from our lab that is Michigan. In my terms as governor, I cut taxes 99 times. I list them in the book. We shrunk government by far. We cut spending by far more than any state in the country because of the economy and the contraction of our budget, of our revenue streams. We cut more public employees by far than any state in the country. And you would think that if small government and cutting taxes were the prescription, that Michigan would then have the most robust economy in the nation. But no, we still had the highest unemployment rate. The only thing that worked was toward the end of my terms, when we got a partner in the federal government and we were able to strategically invest in order to grow sectors that we could be competitive in the United States. So we were able, for example, to grow an electric vehicle battery industry with the help of the federal government through the Recovery Act. Up to that point, we hadn't had a partner in the White House who was willing to intervene. Of course, the White House also intervened to save the auto industry, but as a result of those interventions, our unemployment rate in 2010 dropped 6 times faster than the national average, and the Gallup organization said that Michigan's economy was the most improved. The job performance was the most improved of all of the states. That is the data. So if cutting taxes alone were the solution, it would have worked. It's not, because tax policy has to be tied to job creation in America. If you only cut taxes, you actually may end up facilitating giving businesses extra income to invest where they can get the biggest returns. And where is that? Not in the United States. They can get the biggest returns in developing countries where they can expand markets. You have to tie policy to job creation in the U.S.
There's a sort of apocryphal story that you tell in the book. And again, this book is written by both of you, and you should both chime in on this. But it's the Electrolux story, where it seems like, in effect, you make them an offer they couldn't refuse, and they refuse it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's as good a deal as could be made, and yet the company still takes its business to Mexico.
Right. And maybe I can just tell the story quickly, and you jump in. So you know, we get this call at the end of my first year in office that this big factory, the largest refrigerator factory in North America, in the world actually, was going to be moving from a tiny little town in Michigan who had grown up around refrigerator factory employment. It was going to be moving its 2,700 jobs to Juarez, Mexico. So I said, well, if they're going to move, we're going to make sure that they don't. We're going to put everything we have on the table. So we went to the company and we said, we're going to give you zero taxes for 20 years. We will help to build you a new factory. The workers gave $30 million in concessions per year. The local community said zero personal property taxes. We put everything we had on the table. The company took our list of incentives and they went out of the room for 17 minutes. And they came back in and they said, wow, this is the most generous offer we have ever seen. But there's nothing you can do to compensate for the fact that we can pay $1.57 an hour in Mexico.
Yeah.
That was the wake-up call.
You know, and I would say two things about the question, Dave, that you asked and the story about Electrolux. I mean, one is what's happening to jobs here. People feel bad for Michigan and think Michigan's sort of lost and that manufacturing is just going away. And it's not. So in the first decade of this century, millennium, we lost American companies contracted by 2.5 million manufacturing jobs, American corporations. They grew 2.9 million jobs abroad, American corporations. So there was net job growth.
So there's job creation.
There is job creation.
Net
job growth. Just not here. Now, the second question is, what are governments doing about it and what's their role? Now, here we say, bring a Toyota plant. Jennifer said, bring an LG Chem plant. Bring some battery plants. Bring whatever. We'll take not your huddled masses, but we'll take your new technologies and your job-producing companies. Well, states can do that, but our country has no national policy. Contrast that with China, where our beloved GM just said they're going to give all their Volt technology in GM. They're going to build the batteries in China. They're going to give it to China. That when GM goes to China, Shanghai Motors owns half of that operation. That's not what happens when Toyota comes here. When we go there, they own half of it. Shanghai Motors does. Now, I'm not advocating a communist government, but in that case, Shanghai Motors' interest is in jobs, and they own half of that company there. So what we've got on a national level are China, Singapore, Korea, Sweden, Germany, all going to bat with and for their companies and with and for their employees. And here, we don't have that kind of policy. We have lots of governors, including Republicans running for president, who've been cannibalizing each other and fighting for jobs among themselves. But we don't have a national policy where we're after jobs.
Dan Mulhern and Jennifer Granholm join us. Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan, her husband Dan Mulhern. The book is called The Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Growth. Today they're both teaching at the University of California, Berkeley. I want to return to all of this as we go through the course of our hour, but I want to get at the other part of this story, which is what happened to you, Dan, during this time as when your wife was governor. There's a kind of a funny sort of moment in the book where it's observed that once upon a time you thought you might become governor of Michigan, that you had political aspirations, and that it, you, as you imagined your life, being first gentleman was not exactly the title you thought you would someday hold.
No. I mean, I got to that point and had no idea what to call myself. I mean, what is a guy who's married to a governor? But no, that's absolutely true. My father was very active in government. He was on a city council and ran for mayor when I was in sixth grade. We had public service in our blood. I met this wonderful, intelligent, brilliant person at law school and convinced her to come back to my state with the notion that I would have a career in front of me. On the way, we met a remarkable priest who, in preparing us for marriage, had the incredible prescience to say to me in our third meeting, "Dan, what happens if the party comes to Jennifer and say, you'd be a great candidate? There's an open Senate seat. You're smart. You're capable. You're a lawyer. It's a good time for a woman. How would you feel?" And I told that priest I'd probably be jealous and resentful, but I'd be 100% behind Jennifer if she felt called to do that. And amazingly, that unfolded.
And it seems like, in a sense, both those things were true, that you were the always there in terms of your support, but that it was also not always an easy time. There's a point in the book where you talk about saying to Jennifer, I guess I have to remind you that next week our daughter turns 18.
Right.
That you had to play that primary parental role while she was dealing with 10 million Michiganers.
Yeah. So it's a story on many levels. A governor's story is a governor's story. It's really a people's story, the people of Michigan, and how an old way of life never worked. And a subtext is it's a man's story in a modern world where women are leading. And so you see glimpses into my egoism and my weakness, and also some better moments.
I've got to jump in and defend
where,
you, though.
Where I was helpful to my wife.
Yeah, helpful to your wife and helpful to our kids, who were so blessed to have this incredible dad who was on it full time.
And is there also, I'm curious about whether or not there is, it's not really written about in the book, but are there lessons in that for our time and for our future jobs, that times are changing and that there really are things we all have to think about to recraft both who we are and what we become?
Oh, absolutely, Dave. I was giving a speech in Augusta, Georgia, to a women's chamber of commerce about women's leadership, and I got a call back because I had placed a call in my arrogance to President Clinton. I got a call back from President Clinton, and his wife was on the campaign, and I said to him, "President Clinton, with all due respect, I've been supporting my wife for quite a while. And the important thing is not how brilliant and talented you are, because you're incredible. But the important thing is your emotional support for your wife, and that she needs to be at her best every day. I had seen her on 60 Minutes and didn't think she was her best. Mm-hmm. She needs to be her best. And your job, which you weren't trained for and I wasn't trained for, is to really be loving, emotionally intelligent, supportive, and encouraging." And the great part of this story, Dave, is it's a wonderful story for men. Women saw this huge opportunity for Hillary Clinton, Jennifer Granholm, Carly Fiorina to step into these brand new roles. We, as men, never really realized we were imprisoned, and in many respects we were, and haven't realized this incredible opportunity to love our wives in a new way, to love our children and relate to them in a new way. It's a subtext of the book, but a really positive and wonderful story. I think,
you know, one of the other things that comes out in this book, and I think an important strand of this, is that, you know, perhaps we ought to be deciding who stays home and who goes to work, if you've got kids, based upon, or how you divide up the roles in a marriage, based upon competencies. In effect, you know, I think gay couples have a bit of an easier time with this because they're not bound by their plumbing. You know, they're bound by, you know, who's the best person to be able to, you know, care for the children, and who's the best one, who's got the best opportunity in terms of jobs, et cetera.
Still in all, Dan Mulhern, are you happy to have the title Distinguished Practitioner of Law and Business as opposed to First Gentleman?
Great question. I mean, being in public service is a real honor, and even to be a spouse, I shouldn't say even to be a spouse, but it's an extraordinary honor. So, but I'm glad to be back in the public world. But the funny thing was, Dave, I thought when this was over, it would be my turn. I would get out there in the public sector. What I find is, with a son in ninth grade and two daughters graduated, my real joy and love is to spend that time with him. It goes very fast. And in many ways, my public ambition has been eclipsed by my love for a new role that I found.
I'm curious about what role you want to take on now, Governor Granholm, in terms of advocating really for government. I mean, you're in a position now of teaching at the university, but do you see this as a kind of crusade that you want to make at this point, that this is not the time for government to step back, that this is a time when we really need government to interject in American life all the more?
It's why we wrote this book, because what with the dialogue that's happening now at the presidential level and all of the discussion, when I see the debates by the Republican candidates, particularly those who are influenced by the Tea Party, where and those who've signed pledges by, you know, saying that they will never, ever, 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 ever raise revenue or raise taxes. It makes me so frustrated because I know what our economic competitors are doing. Just a quick story. I was in China in March, and we were meeting with a group called Securing America's Future Energy and the Chinese government to see what they were doing to attract all of these solar jobs. In fact, they've gotten a lot from California. What is it that they're doing? And they were bragging about it. And so at one of the meetings, one of the officials pulled me aside and said, "When do you think the United States is going to get national energy policy?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. The Tea Party, it's so divisive, etc." What he did was he rubbed his hands together and smiled and said, "Take your time," because they see our passivity as their opportunity.
But this is also something you write about in the book, which is that it's not exactly a fair fight. I mean, in China, there are enormous advantages for free land for those solar companies to develop, you know, cheap labor. How do you compete with that? How do you contend? Because there's no going back. We can't sort of turn off globalization.
Right.
So what do we do with that?
Of course, we have got to do what other countries do, not become communist, obviously, have an active government partnership with the private sector. So Singapore is an example. They have something called the triple helix or the golden triangle. Sweden has the same, where they have partnership between government, the universities, and the private sector. They've identified their strengths in terms of the sectors that they make them competitive. States have all done this, but we have no resources. A state at California or Michigan or any state doesn't have the tools because we have to balance our budgets. We don't have any finances to be able to compete against China. But in countries like Sweden and Singapore, et cetera, they have teamed up with the private sector to say, here, we're going to create a cluster of jobs in a particular area that we know we're going to be successful in. We're going to streamline permitting. We're going to introduce you to suppliers and to customers. We are going to make it easy for you to be competitive. In other words, they have a national economic strategy. We don't have that in this country.
We're coming up on a break, but you probably know where I want to go next, which is the other side of this, which is the Solyndra story, which happened here in the Bay Area, and the problem that can happen when you place your bets on something that doesn't turn out. Just give me – we'll come back to this after the break. But what do you take from that, Dan Mulhern? I mean
– well, as Jennifer will say more articulately than I, if you don't place any bets, you're going to lose them all. And so what we need to do is have government involved in a way that it's hedging its bets and it's protecting. For instance, the president's new tax credits for small business are tied to job development. So you don't pay them out. Companies don't cash them in until the jobs are created. So government needs to be smart about the way it does things. But sometimes in a new sector, you're going to take some chances. Jennifer's got 18 new energy companies in Michigan. So that was one of $40 billion, I think, in investments, 39 different companies. I may have my numbers a little bit off, but yes, you're going to lose some.
Dan Mulhern and Jennifer Granholm join us. Their new book is called A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. When we come back, we'll take your calls as well. If you have a question about how you think government ought to function during these difficult times, we'd like to hear your observations. 866-733-6786 is the number. Or if you question about how you contend with dual careers and single parenthood in effect and what you do when you have two people contending with these things, we'd like to hear from you as well. 866-733-6786. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm and her husband Dan Mulhern. They've written a book about her time in office. It's called A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. We'd like to hear your observations as well about the role of government in our lives today and how you juggle different roles within that life if you're both professional people and how you contend with those situations too. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our Facebook page as well. We were talking about Solyndra right before our break, and we have someone on the line who wants to ask about that. So let's take off from that point and talk a little bit more about the Solyndra situation before we get to our caller. You were going to chime in on your own effort to try to get alternative energy programs as part of the rebound in Michigan.
Right. And just to build on Dan's point, I mean, Solyndra is one of a program where there were 40 companies that actually got those loan guarantees. Solyndra was the one that failed. But the bottom line is there are 100,000 Americans working in solar. We had a similar opportunity in Michigan where we vied to get advanced batteries for the electric vehicle, partnered with the federal government, competed for those grants and loan guarantees. And as a result of that, within 18 months, we had 18 companies that had come to Michigan, projected to create 63,000 jobs. One of them, A123, just hired their 1,000th person. So if we want to lead as a nation in the advanced technology, sometimes you have to invest upstream. And not all of those bets are going to win, as anyone in Silicon Valley will tell you. You've got to place some bets. But if we do not, nothing. Our economic competitors are only too happy to step into the breach.
Some email questions coming in. Asking former Governor Granholm how to create jobs is like asking a demolition expert to help build your house. Response.
Well, I mean, the assumption there is that a governor of a state has some ability to stop the bankruptcies in the auto industry or globalization. I think that the question, with all due respect to the questioner, is someone who perhaps has a political perspective. The bottom line is no governor has the ability to stop globalization. What we do have the ability to do is to deal with it on the ground by diversifying the economy. And in 2008, when General Motors and Chrysler declared bankruptcy, that's exactly when we started to partner with the federal government to invest in order to grow jobs. And that's why Michigan's economy actually did see the rebound that it saw at the end of my second term.
I'd say, asking Jennifer Granholm about jobs is like asking Rudy Giuliani about terrorist attacks. I mean, we got hit incredibly hard, and Jennifer spent 8 years obsessing, thinking, talking to the best business experts in the globe, presidents of corporations as well as presidents of countries. So this is a real look from somebody who is deeply, deeply involved in
it. And is it also partially, and not to make this sound too civics lesson-like, part of what is of value here is understanding what government can do and what it can't, and what state government can do versus what it can't. You describe in the book a situation where you're talking with someone named Sean McAllendon.
McAllendon.
At the Center for Automotive Research, and he says to you at one point, honestly, state policy will be ineffective for a while. Tax incentives will be meaningless to these declining companies. There's nothing you or any governor can do to fix this.
Right. And that's the issue for us as a nation, is what can be the role of state and federal government, not to get back old manufacturing jobs that we know that we have lost, but looking forward, what are the sectors that we know as a nation we can be competitive in order for us to go after those?
Well, let's say, here's an email question, and then we'll get to our calls. Stephen writes in, perhaps it's time to recognize that we are a post-manufacturing economy. No one is talking about this issue and how we deal with the fact that we have too many people for too few of those jobs. Do you agree with that, that we're a post-manufacturing economy?
I think that if we continue to do nothing, we will end up being a post-manufacturing economy. And is that what we really want to be? In fact, a Stanford Nobel Prize-winning economist named Michael Spence just did a study of the nation's economy and found that the tradable goods jobs, which are the manufacturing kinds of jobs, have continued to leave the United States. And the increase in jobs has only been on the services side. But the challenge with that is that the reason why you're seeing our GDP and our wages go down is because it's the manufacturing jobs that pay better and they have a bigger ripple effect in the economy. economy. For every one auto job, there are seven ancillary jobs in the economy that are created. For a nation to not manufacture will mean that that nation will be a weak nation. Not only will you not be able to make things and have jobs for your people in that regard, but you won't be able to manufacture the means for your own self-defense. You won't be able to manufacture the means for your own energy security. And I'm not saying all manufacturing. I know that we have lost the repetitive motion, low-skilled manufacturing. Right. But advanced manufacturing, you better believe we can compete on that. But we have to partner with business so that they can be competitive in a global economy when they locate in the United States.
Dan Mulhern, let me get your take on this, because you ran a business before Jennifer was elected governor and wrote a book about leadership and getting results in business. How do you see that?
Well, I think that Jennifer is absolutely right, and the emailer is absolutely right, that manufacturing as we knew it is gone. In other words, low skill, high wage, that equation is gone, because now low skill is low wage. It's called China. It's called Singapore. It's called Bangladesh. We could go on and on. So we are not going to have that kind of work in this country, in part because of globalization and in part because of technology. The factories that I worked in as I worked my way through college in Detroit are nothing like the factories now. The automation and technology is huge. And so we cannot depend on that as a source of jobs. The other thing that's important is if we're competing, not just in manufacturing, but in service, in financial instruments, in all kinds of areas, even in the law, we have to add value in a different kind of way. We have to bolster education. Everybody's got to be adding value, because the easy stuff, the low-hanging fruit, is gone. And this is the public tragedy to me in Michigan and California, is cutting education at a time like this.
And before we do more on education, which is an important part of your book, an important part of what you focus on the end in terms of what government can and should do, let's take a couple of calls.
Sure.
And then we'll return to that. Lisa joins us first from Mountain View. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I think this is great, I have a question, which is that we've spent 200 years creating labor-saving devices, in mechanical and computational, but we haven't spent much effort innovating our social system, and we really have no way to pay people for the work that machines do. Our productivity is way up, but people are still looking at manufacturing. So we need a way to pay the people whose work is being done by the machines instead of paying the capitalists who own the machines. And I'm wondering if searching for jobs is less important than searching for restructuring the way we distribute our money.
Yeah, really interesting point about how we contend, because we are more productive. That's the irony in all of this.
Right. I mean, I think we have two problems, Lisa. Number one is this country does not believe in redistributing income on its own. Republicans don't. Democrats don't. We believe in work, and work has dignity, and we need to figure out how to get people to work. Number two, we can't compete in the globe. Our wealth will shrink. We won't be producing anything, as Jennifer is saying, and therefore there ain't going to be wealth to redistribute. So we have got to figure out how to make people more productive, to make us more dynamic, more collaborative, more leadership-oriented, so that everyone is creating the kind of wealth and kind of value and productivity that you are so rightly saying businesses have been doing.
Yeah, and I would just want to say a word about the machines and the improvements in technology. Today, in a factory, you're not going to see thousands of people like you did before. There's no doubt. It's a much more streamlined effort. But you need workers to know how to program the robots. You need people who know how to build those machines and those robots. That's a very technologically advanced operation. The vehicle itself, only 7% of a car is labor costs, because so much technology in it. You drive the most technologically advanced mass-produced product in the world, and those workers have to have the skills that are necessary to do an advanced manufacturing line. And that's why the United States can compete on this, because we do have skilled people who are able to do it. But if we don't go after it, if we don't have an active government — I'm not talking about a big government, I'm talking about an active government who is willing to partner to get those businesses to come here — we're not even going to have those those jobs.
And this takes us also right back to education and something you both focus on in the book about retraining workers, getting people back to school, because that's really – if we don't do that, it sounds to me like you think we need to do both things. We have to cut. We have to be small and lean and fast in government and at the same time really invest, especially in education.
But you have to cut in order to invest. You have to cut – I mean, I used to say you have to cut what's important in order to invest in what's essential. And what's essential is job creation and education, and you cannot have one without the other.
And let's go to Dan, a former Michigander. Dan, go ahead, please.
Good morning. I just wanted to thank the governor. I'm a former Michigander now living in San Francisco because, A, there's economic opportunity, and, B, it's a cool city. And I think the governor worked very, very hard to make Michigan competitive economically and also to make Michigan cities cool. And I wanted to thank you for that, Governor. And I also wanted to ask you what your thoughts are with regards to tax credits. My understanding is Michigan has always been in the forefront or had always been in the forefront of tax credit incentive programs to redevelop cities, to get clean energy technology. And under your administration, of course, there were the film credits that were developed. And as I'm sure you're aware, those have been largely gutted by the current administration. I'm wondering where you think the future of tax credit programs lie, both in the state of Michigan and on a macro level in the U.S.
Dan, thanks.
Yeah, Dan, thanks. Thanks so much for your comments. And maybe one day you'll be back in Michigan. But the bottom line is I think tax credits are a really very shrewd way to be able to diversify an economy, to be able to direct behavior and reward performance. In other words, as Dan said earlier, the tax credits that we offered only were paid out if the jobs were created. We identified sectors in Michigan's economy that we wanted to move into. We needed to do a creative sector. Film, and I know California's obviously got a big leg up on everybody in this, but film is one area where we could retrain auto workers to work behind and build sets and work cameras, et cetera. And they were so excited. We had all of these stars coming in. It created this whole opportunity. People were excited. A lot of people working in the film industry because of the credits that we were offering to create an industry in Michigan.
So is a tax cut not a tax cut, not a tax credit? I mean, you were making the argument earlier that just cutting taxes in and of itself isn't going to create jobs. Is it about being smart and strategic and about which kind of credit or cut you make?
Yeah, absolutely. On both sides of the equation, you got to think like a business. For instance, there isn't a business in the world that would do what 10 Republican presidential contenders did in the Fox debate. When asked, if you were given the opportunity right now with this debt ceiling issue in front of you of having 10 parts cuts, one part taxes, would you take it? Every one of them said no. I don't know a business person in the world who would take a 10-to-1 ratio and walk away from it. So we're really not very bright. Our legislators, for instance, refused to tax rental cars. That money was going to be used for our wonderful advertising campaign. You've seen it in California, our Pure Michigan ads with Tim Allen's spectacular voice about what an incredible paradise we lived in. We were going to tax rental cars. It wasn't even Michigan citizens. 80% of the money would come from people coming into the state of Michigan. Our citizens were paying those taxes in Florida whenever they went to Disneyland. But would our legislature pass them? They said, it's a tax. We're not going to pass a tax. There isn't a business in the world that wouldn't pass on a price increase if they thought they could get away with it without losing, if they could gain through a price increase. But we've become nuts in this country looking at revenue.
To the issue of what will direct behavior, though, I mean, there's all this discussion right now about whether those who pay capital gains tax should be paying capital gains tax at the same rate as those who are working for those hedge fund managers. Well, I mean, think about it. We're in a global economy. What do the hedge fund managers do with that extra marginal income they get from paying the lower taxes? They invest it. What are they invested in? They invested in a global marketplace. What are the companies doing that get those investments? They are multinational companies. They invest in a global economy. Where do they invest? They invest where they can get the best return. They are responsible to their shareholders to maximize their fiduciary obligations. If we give them a tax cut without tying the benefits of it to the United States, we may be facilitating investment and job creation in other countries.
And back to our calls. Kevin joins us next from San Jose. Kevin, go ahead.
Thank you. It's amazing to me that the elephant in the room that hasn't been talked about and the villain is American wages, which are, I believe for the auto industry are about twice what the rest of the world is, and we make an inferior automobile. How are we going to beat this? It's almost like American manufacturing base is bound to decline along with everything else. If we can't make a superior product, we're bound to lose. The only example I know of to the contrary would be Germany. Your comments, please. Thank you.
Kevin, yeah, thanks.
What was his name?
Kevin.
Kevin. Kevin, first of all, with all due respect, I think you're caught in the 20th century in terms of the quality issues. The vehicles that are now coming from the domestic automakers have won Car of the Year, Best Car of the Year, Quality of the Year. I mean, Dan and I drive
J.D. Power surveys.
The old paradigm, you are absolutely right. But the new auto industry, new leadership, new UAW, new wage structure, which has entry-level employees making the same as the international companies, it's a totally different world. So I want to beg your question. But it was true in the past, and we don't deny that. That obviously is what contributed to a lot of the difficulties. But the point being that if only 7% of a vehicle is tied to wages, and the wages are now of both the international companies and the domestic automakers are now on par, why wouldn't we continue to be going after those automaker factories, et cetera, to be able to provide wages for the people who do work there.
But to Kevin's point about wages, you were telling the Electrolux story earlier, that what drove Electrolux or why they said they had to go elsewhere was the cost of wages. And it does bring us to this question also of unions and changing times. You had a lot of labor support, traditionally Democrats, but have that kind of support. But is that also something that needs to be addressed in a more sort of straightforward way, that unions have to change and that Democratic leaders have to be willing to push that message?
Yeah, I think absolutely. But here's the kicker on it is that someone like Bob King, who's now head of the UAW, the new leader of the UAW, he completely gets this. In fact, the new contract that was just signed this week with General Motors, it makes General Motors create more jobs in the United States without adding to their bottom line. What Bob King told the auto industry in a conference that they held every year is that this is the new UAW. We are here to help you be globally competitive by creating jobs in America. This is not labor versus management anymore. This is about giving you quality. The new contracts that are being negotiated have a motto of anyone can do any job, anywhere, anytime. You walk on a factory floor right now in a UAW factory, you won't be able to tell who is on the line as an hourly worker and who is management. Everyone is working in teams. It's a different paradigm.
And does that paradigm also need to move now to what in some ways is a tougher obstacle, which is public
employees? Public employees. Yes, now, this I'm glad you said.
Absolutely has to. And, you know, one of the things in Michigan is that the UAW, being the powerful union that it is, actually unionized most or a huge portion of our public sector workers. So the state government had the UAW as its adversary at the bargaining table. Jennifer got more in terms of positive, constructive, collaborative negotiations from the UAW. They took furlough days. They take 20% and pay into their health care benefits. They're off of a deferred benefit plan and onto a defined
So there's more flexibility there than there was within the public employee world.
Absolutely. And, you know, this happened without the state you lived in, Wisconsin, where they had horrific head-to-head battles because there was such a demonization of labor. So we don't need to demonize business or demonize labor. They both serve important interests and they need to come to the table together.
Here's an interesting question from Bradley, who writes in, please ask your guests and the former governor about the view of elected officials needing to balance between what they believe their constituents demand in terms of governmental change versus what those same political leaders believe they need to be doing. In other words, sort of telling the truth about where what needs to be done versus what constituents might demand.
Well, it's a phenomenal question. I'll tell a quick story and let Jennifer answer it. We were preparing for a State of the State speech, and one of the few public roles I played was to help in speech writing and strategy with the governor. I said to Jennifer in 2007, I think it was, I really think you need to say to the citizens, we need to support public education. We all need to come together. We need to decide that this is a time where we have to invest in ourselves and the government is not the enemy. And one of her key staffers said, Dan, with all due respect, people don't come to the State of the state to hear what they think the governor wants them to do for that, for her. They come to the state of the state to hear what she's going to do for them. My ears were ringing with John F. Kennedy. Ask not what your country can do for you. But Jennifer, pick it up there in terms of the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's whenever you have an election, a politician wants to get elected. And if they come to the people and say, you know what? Things are, we all have to change. And that means you've got to upskill yourself. That means you are going to have to go back to college. It means that the old manufacturing jobs aren't here. If you're completely candid with people and say, I'm just one person, I'm a governor, I can't impact a global economy, people are going to look at you and say, well, why would I elect you when I can elect the guy who's coming with a cape and a wand and who says he's going to fix it all? It's the same parallels you're seeing at the presidential level. You know, you have candidates who say, I'm going to bring jobs back to this country. Like, I was listening to Rick Santorum the other night saying he's going to bring manufacturing back to this country. I'm like, how are you going to do? I'd like to hear how you're going to do it when all of your prescription is just merely to cut taxes and cut the size of government. You have to be candid with people, but there is a question of pacing the learning in a way that allows you to get to the seat.
This is a slightly different tack on this, but it reminds me of another portion of your book, in your book, where you talk about the debate within your administration over whether you should say a particular line. And I think it was also yes. the State of the State speech. And again, it has to do with this question of leadership. And you wanted to include a line that said, people are going to be blown away by how much progress we make. And your staff said, God, no, don't say that. And in the end, you stuck it back in.
I stubbornly stuck it back in, and it was a big mistake. But, I mean, you know, here's what I would
but
say.
But expectations are a problem. It's a problem this administration has faced.
But it's a problem for politicians themselves. You want to believe everything you say. I mean, I really did believe when I said, Michigan, you're going to be blown away by the progress we've made in 5 years, you know, and my opponent, and that was an election year, my opponent took that, you're going to be blown away, and used it like a club at me for the entire election. Because, of course, our economy was so challenged, another parallel with what's going on here on the national level. But bottom line is, you want to be able to give people hope. You want to be able to say there is a plan to be able to move us forward. You want to be able to say, if you elect me, our team will fix this problem. But you also have to recognize the reality on the ground and that there are no quick fixes to these issues. It's not going to happen overnight. And telling people that sometimes leadership is planting trees under whose shade you will never sit may not be that satisfactory to the citizens who want immediate results, understandably.
Alex writes in, no one has mentioned the situation during when U.S. manufacturing was on the ascension. There were tariffs that compensated for differences in wages. And he goes on to say we should do away with all our trade agreements. Where do you come down on that, on NAFTA and CAFTA and all the rest?
Well, I would say two things. Number one, you can't go back, as you said, Dave. We're in a global economy. We're incredibly interdependent. And that's a good thing, and it's not going to change. But number two, you have to recognize that other countries play the game very differently than we do. They're very interested in jobs. They're very protective. We were in a situation with Korea about 5 years ago where we sold about 5,000 – Jennifer will correct me on the numbers – about 5,000 American cars were sold in Korea, and 500,000 Korean cars were sold here. That's not a straight-up quality issue. That's not a straight-up cost issue. That's an issue of a government that's fighting to keep its products in front of its people and not allow others. So we need to negotiate tough trade agreements. We need to be unafraid to enforce those trade agreements. And we need to look in other ways to be much more aggressive than we are at bringing jobs to this country. State governments do it. Our president doesn't. Go ahead,
James. I was going to say, we are really a pussycat at the World Trade Organization as a nation. We need a tiger. So when other countries are putting up tariffs and taxes to prevent our products from entering, we ought to be taking that to the World Trade Organization, and we should consider what we're going to do in response. People look at what the United States does in the world trade environment, and they laugh. Here's what I would say. We need to trade. It's really important, but we also have to enforce the rules so that we have a level playing field. And we cannot sit idly by when other countries manipulate their currency or make it impossible for our country to export products and say, oh, that's okay. We have got to take action. And that's what one of the solutions that we need to do is to play both offense and defense. And that's a defensive posture.
And to Deborah in El Cerrito. Deborah, go ahead, please.
Good morning. I am so impressed with your grasp of the issues and the knowledge, hopefully you have residency established here, and my question is this. At some point, would you be willing to run for governor of the state of California?
Oh, Lord, save us. No, I think I've served 12 years in the public side, and, you know, Dan and I are serving in a way, certainly, and feel very honored to do so at the University of California, Berkeley. But I'm certainly happy to be able to talk about the lessons that we learned, because you don't want to leave the, you know, the situation without some lessons. And so that's part of the reason why we wrote the book. But I appreciate the sentiment.
Thanks for the call. Brandon is next. Brandon, go ahead, please, with a quick question.
Hi, you guys. First of all, I've heard lots of references to Friedman's book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, which I think explains a lot about the globalization and the paradigm shift that everybody's wondering why jobs aren't here. But my question is, you mentioned the success in Singapore and Sweden. And I think here we have a lot of examples where, for example, the CIO of Solyndra, he was, you know, just super overpaid for failure, and then pleads the fifth. The leaving executive of HP gives the golden parachute of $14 million. Is there that kind of discrepancy in executive pay in those countries?
Great question, Brandon. I'm going to hold you there just because we're short on time. Quick response.
Absolutely. I think there is no doubt if you look at the way other countries compensate their CEO. If you look at Japan, I mean, they cannot imagine the kind of disparity between the workers and the CEO. It is, it reeks of such unfairness. The lack of fairness. And it really exacerbates what you're seeing right now on Wall Street, all these people protesting because they feel like they've got nowhere else to go, and the rich are getting richer, and the folks, the 99%, are just feeling like we got the shaft.
We're out of time. Just one last quick question for you. There's a point in the book where you observe a phone call that you had from the White House where a White House aide says that, you know, President just said when we got off the line that you have the toughest job in America as governor of Michigan. He probably now has
of
that
title. Of course,
title.
And we said that. I mean, I said that. My goodness, coming from him.
But what would you say now to if the president called you back up? What would you say?
I would say that what he's doing right now, which is to demonstrate to America, A, that he has a plan and that he's going to fight for that plan and that he's got people on the other side who are not willing to compromise one penny. He's taking it to the people, and America has to listen. If you want our Washington to move forward, then you need to hire and fire those who are doing it or not doing it.
Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan, Dan Mulhern, their book, A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. Thanks both very much for
being
here today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave.
Pleasure to have you here. Yeah. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer, and Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.